Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. We've had a productive morning with Edward Morris of Citigroup talking about various and sundry on oil. Ed, to get started here, and I know Francine's got some other themes to speak of as well, there is this word in economics, elasticity, or the responsiveness of oil. With the new technology and with American oil, with shale and all the rest, fracking and all that, what is our elasticity of American supply of oil? How different is it from our ute?
Well, if you look deep water projects, it takes 10 years from the time you decide to explore, if you're successful, and then produce oil from the deep water. Shale, particularly now that we have significant infrastructure in the producing basins, is really a 6-month to 9-month lag. So you make a decision to drill, you get everything together, you hedge it out, and we ought to talk about the hedging part of it, and 6 months later, oil comes out of the ground.
So how do you hedge it? Let's get right to it.
So there's massive hedging that's taken place. I wouldn't be surprised when the data come in that the fourth quarter would have seen the largest amount ever. And the producers have a $50 trigger point. We can talk as much as we want about break-even prices. $50 brings the producers into hedge, and they hedge a lot. And then it doesn't really matter where the price of oil is going for the next 2 years.
But that always, always, always ends ugly. When you overhedge in commodities, there's a point where it's great, 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 great. Oops.
This is a cyclical business, and the turning points happen faster than you think. They're hard to plan on. You've got, particularly in the U.S., 10,000 independent producers making independent decisions of one another. They may be independent, but it is a herd mentality at work. There's no mastermind orchestrating all of this, and it's really hard to turn it off once it really gets turned on and going.
Ed, will U.S. crude stockpiles change under Trump's administration because of his energy policy?
Well, ironically, U.S. crude stockpiles are on the way down in terms of strategic stocks. That started in the Obama administration. It's likely to continue in the Trump administration. You simply don't need 700 million barrels of oil in inventory in order to ward off an emergency when you're moving towards self-sufficiency and maybe even the U.S. becoming a net hydrocarbon exporter and in that a net oil exporter. So strategic stock policy may have an overhaul before the end of this administration. The administration does have an energy policy. It's more, 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 with less environmental control.
Does Mexico have an energy policy, or is it just triage month to month, quarter to quarter?
They have a dual energy policy. One is to streamline Pemex and get it to be competitive. Hard to do given the amount of labor they have to employ under various national programs. So it's hard to tame a state monopoly other than depriving it of cash. And they deprived it of cash, and they've invited foreigners in to orchestrate new supply. Yeah. So that's a big change in policy.
And Francine, the backdrop of this for our global audience is not one but two Trump cabinet secretaries are in Mexico City as we speak, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Homeland Security. Remarkable.
Yeah, it's absolutely remarkable. Ed, you're probably one of the most optimistic when it comes to the oil price. What do the bears get wrong?
Well, the bears may get timing wrong. We are entering a just new world of oil where we're getting incremental supply from countries that used to be massive importers of supply from other parts of the world. We're having changes in the demand structure of the world. The growth of production from Brazil, from Canada, and the U.S. over the past 7 years, even with the U.S. falling back as part of the short cycle nature of response to low prices. But these three countries have transformed the Atlantic Basin from being a supply deficit arena to a supply surplus arena, one that is moving oil as we speak to the Far East. And this is a big challenge for all other oil-producing countries, whether Russia or whether Saudi Arabia. We're seeing only one place in the world where demand is growing, and it's a very enhanced competitive market. A truce that's been called between the OPEC and non-OPEC countries can't last long when we're going to see more North American, South American, Atlantic Basin crude heading into the Pacific Basin.
And you don't think you're underestimating the impact and the strength of shale? I don't know if it's ever possible. I know they're bitty and they have different break-even points, that all of these shale producers actually come together to really form some kind of force.
Well, you know, we were all talking earlier about where oil prices are in real terms. The remarkable feature of the market is that after a 5 to 10 year period of unbelievable cost inflation, we're seeing cost deflation at work. Costs of production have dramatically fallen. Let me give you one good example.
Please.
There's this Johan Sverdrup project in Norway, discovered, made 10 years ago. It was called off by Statoil, the operator, in 2014 when they saw that the break-even full cost accounting price was $60 a barrel. They relaunched it in 2016, saying last winter that the break-even price has come down to substantially below 40. In the late spring, they said it was 30, and this past fall, 25. So going from 60 to 25 is an incredible example of cost deflation. And we don't see much on the horizon to reverse that anytime soon.
Well, let me rip the script here. You mentioned Norway, and to help our London audience, good morning to all of you in London listening on Bloomberg Radio. Give us an update on North Sea oil. I remember sitting in Edinburgh with Alex Salmon of the S&P, and he's got some oil abilities in his work at RBS years ago. And there was a North Sea story 10, 15, 20 years ago. Is there a North Sea story for 2020?
Probably the North Sea will still be there, and it may well be that they're going to be producing more than they are today. The project that I talked about when it starts up in 2019 is expected to deliver 660,000 barrels a day of oil equivalent, mostly oil, a little bit of gas. That's not going to be the only offshore rough water project that's going to start up, because once you get one, then the play is open to others. So North Sea is not going to go away. It doesn't play the role it played at the beginning of the century, but it's still an important one.
Ed, I know you see oil between $40 and $65 this year. Is there a danger that if they pull back, a lot of these oil majors, if they're pulling too much back on investment, that we then see oil shoot back up to 100 two, 3 years from now?
Yeah, well, 45 to 60 is really, 65 is really a five-year horizon, not a this-year horizon. I wouldn't be surprised if there were a sell-off in the market, given the length of managed money in the market today. I wouldn't be surprised to see prices falling to 50 or 49 for a few instances, but we're not going to see that kind of price volatility this year, we don't imagine.
No.
That's more in the distance. And saying that, if OPEC really were trying to destroy the non-OPEC market, what they should do is work for a world of enhanced volatility, not stability. You want volatility to stop the CapEx from coming into the market. Stability is their stated friend, but it's their worst enemy.
Edward Morse with us. I know Francine in London wants to go to OPEC. I agree with her strongly on this. If you were to write the acclaimed Ed Morse article for Foreign Affairs magazine, and I'm going to give you the title of it. We're going to go to Baroness Thatcher, Expect the Unexpected. So that's the title of your article for CFR and Foreign Affairs magazine. What's the Expect the Unexpected in the oil business when you look at OPEC and non-OPEC?
Well, I think the unexpected is that OPEC and non-OPEC won't be terms that are going to be useful in explaining anything. We're moving toward a world in which there are three giant oil-producing countries, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Russia. And the interplay geopolitically among the three of them and with markets, I think, will be the most significant set of factors in the market over the next 10 years.
Ed, what do we misunderstand about OPEC? I remember covering it 15, 16 years ago, and these guys used to arrive at the Intercontinental in Vienna. They used to say one thing, and the market would shoot up or go down by $3. Will they ever regain that again?
They've regained it a little bit only because they drove out 1,200,000 barrels a day of U.S. production. They wanted to drive out more. They didn't succeed in doing that. The pain got great enough that in one last gasp, they orchestrated a 24-country agreement. That in itself, by definition, is fragile. You can't have a 24-country agreement in a world where the market is really increasingly competitive. And I think the big difference for OPEC is not just the rise of competition from outside on a permanent basis, but also transparency. OPEC could rule the roost when the world wasn't transparent, when you didn't know really how much oil was going to be produced, when you had to rely on the rhetoric of key OPEC countries, and the world just gotten too transparent. The world knows whether OPEC and non-OPEC countries are agreeing. They can track vessels at sea. They can look at loadings from satellites that are orbiting the planet. And they don't control the flow of information any longer.
Do they no longer cheat? And if it is, does it smell of desperation?
Well, if they, quote, cheated, the world would know it. They have a production agreement. You can measure supply. Cheating is more critical when countries can cheat than when they can't cheat. So one of the factors in this agreement is that basically nobody can add more production to the market. We had significant growth of some 650,000 barrels a day from Iraq in 2015. We had 800,000 barrels a day from Iran in 2016. And actually, inventories didn't budge very much. They grew between 2014 and the beginning of 2016 by a huge amount, a good 600 million barrels of crude oil, petroleum products, natural gas liquids. That number came down a bit in 2016, despite the no OPEC, non-OPEC agreement, and despite an added 800,000 barrels a day from Iran. Right. But nobody's there to add a lot to this market.
Right. Can actually OPEC regain control even if Russia doesn't play ball?
The short answer to that is would really be hard. The higher price that you get, the less control they have over the rest of the world. And that would include Russia. Russian production, the Saudis anticipated when they went into a market share strategy in 2014. They thought that Russia was going to see a 300 to 500,000 barrel a day decline. So did the Russian government. And Russian production kept growing.
Let me get one more question in here, bring it back to Oklahoma. T. Boone Pickens, out front with the T. Boone Pickens plan on natural gas. Can T. Boone Pickens prosper with that gas transportation in an Ed Morse world?
The problem with that T. Boone Pickens confronted is that, well, he thought that natural gas prices would be competitive with oil prices. He thought they were both going to be higher. So the Pickens plan was based effectively on a high hydrocarbon price environment.
Yeah.
And we're not seeing that. We're seeing U.S. nat gas as even more abundant than U.S. oil. And the U.S. is growing. It's already gone from being where the expectations when the Pickens plan came into effect was that the U.S. gas market was going to remain tight. And we've got in Appalachia, of all places, if Appalachia were an independent area, it would be the third largest natural gas producing country in the world. That's
unreal.
Unreal. A big difference. And under Trump, building pipelines will get that gas in increasing volumes into the market.
More than generous. Ed Morse, thank you so much for Citigroup, folks. That was fabulous. The idea of, oil prices nudge up. But earlier, Ed Morse suggesting that getting back to 1968 real oil valuations is a tangible and feasible thing. That was wonderful. Ed Morse of Citigroup. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. It is always a good time to speak with Michael Mayo on banking, but it is particularly appropriate on this perfect spring day with CLSA because there is a bank reset going on. Mike, to get my attention, JP Morgan shares 86-ish, and you would suggest a 20% plus pop to 102 out in the vicinity. What will be the catalyst for Mr. Dimon to mint more money?
Well, Tom, as you know, we call J.P. Morgan the LeBron James of banking because they're good at both offense and defense. J.P. Morgan, really for the last decade through the financial crisis, has gotten the job done through defense, and we think they're on the cusp of showing greater offense after showing flat revenues this decade. Well, we think those are poised to increase 1/4 over the next 3 years.
I mean, Mike, within this, and this is critical, folks, is and this is what Mayo's so good at. He can go granular on individual stocks, and then look at the industry as well. Are we set now for a tangible book ratio reset, where finally we get a jump condition in book valuations of the various banks?
Well, that's a great question, Tom. And I know you're a CFA, so you asked the right questions. But it's not so much, it's back to the future. We're not, you know, paving new ground here. This is just going back to where banks historically have been when they've created value, when they've had double-digit ROEs, and that's where banks are likely to head.
Mike, what looks cheap right now? I'm looking at a price-to-book ratio for S&P Financial, the sector there, compared to European stocks. I mean, you guys are way above us.
You know, the big difference is U.S. banks are likely to create value that, in financial terms, that's generate returns above the cost of capital, where that's less true for the European banks. And that makes all the difference in the world. That's our whole theme. Our theme is back in black, meaning banks are on the doorstep of creating value. And when you create value, you have another different valuation than banks that don't create value.
Right. So how do they change that? How do they start creating value?
Well, you create value two ways. Number one is you improve your returns. And we think the U.S. banks will improve the returns through the, over half the business, that's traditional lending. Higher interest rates are very good, maybe an acceleration in loan growth. And the other half of the business, a little bit more of a risk on when it comes to capital markets. The other way to create value, which I think is very underappreciated, is to reduce your risk. And banks have increased their risk, especially in the United States, where the balance sheets are the strongest in a generation. And so better returns for less risk also deserves a higher valuation.
But money is still cheap. With the good view of Michael Mayo, with tangible book expansion, with the enthusiasm over the Trump bump, as you write in your research report, is it time for dinosaurs mating? Is this where the regional banks become less regional and we get more super regionals below the too big to fails?
Well, you frame the question correctly. The largest banks are prohibited from buying other banks. So you don't have acquisitions with Citigroup, JP Morgan, Bank America, and Wells Fargo. Certainly below that top level, there's the potential for additional acquisitions, and the benefit of acquisitions is scale. And I do think on the retail banking side, you are seeing the benefits of scale. Look at Bank America. Bank America has a level of deposit transactions through mobile devices equal to over 800 branches. You could separate that out and you have your own regional bank just with mobile banking.
That's brilliant. I mean, within that, Mike, and that's a brilliant observation. The idea of a digital bank within a traditional bank goes back to the further technological advancement here. I'm going to ask the question I've asked you 14 times. When do the branch banks go away? They're all, I mean, near the Pierre Hotel here, there's 5 banks on one corner. I don't know how you do that, but they do it in New York. When's it disappear?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, ever since my kids don't even like it. Ever since they changed an ice cream store into a bank branch, they realized
exactly. This.
There's 87,000 branches in the United States. We think that gets reduced by 10,000 over the next several years. But if you had a level similar to the 1950s, that would, instead of being 87,000, be 52,000. But as customers have greater acceptance of mobile banking, which they're doing, I mean, this is a tipping point, you are going to see banks close more branches. You've seen several announcements. The one laggard on those branch closures is Wells Fargo, which is hanging out there with 6,000 branches compared to Bank America, which is 1/4 less.
Mike, I don't know how old your kids are, so I don't know if they'll bank with Citi or Bank of America, any of those. But when are we going to see a Facebook bank or one of these names that actually speak to millennials? And can they go through it with regulation and actually get market share?
You know, there's been a lot of talk. Think back to the 1990s when it was clicks for bricks, and you had internet hype at that time. It got a little excessive at the time. And who's going to dethrone the banks? But I think the winners with digital banking, it's going to be the major banks. And by the way, if you have a small startup that's doing well, a large bank's probably going to buy them. And you're seeing that the traction with the large banks right now. So, and you are seeing millennials bank with some of the larger banks. It doesn't mean that startups can't get, you know, those customers who are disenfranchised with the large banks, or doesn't mean startups and smaller players, you know, can't get the crumbs. But the winners in digital banking, it's an easy call. It's going to be the largest banks. They have the technology budgets to spend or even buy some people.
Right. Give me names. It's not. It can't be all the large
brutal.
Banks, right?
You're ruthless.
I know. So you're a P&A come.
Yeah. Well, no, in retail banking, you're seeing traction, you know, at a Bank of America. I mean, it's happening in front of us, and the cost to deliver has declined. And so I think J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, I mean, these are the big banks getting it done for retail banking.
Mike, help me here with operating income. It's a terrible story of woe, folks. Coming out of Lehman, $5 billion free cash flow at Bank of America. Now it's only $24 billion. It's gone from $5 billion to $24 billion. We've got it modeled at Bloomberg out to $30 billion a few years out. What are they going to do with all that cash? Is it a double-digit dividend grower for some of these cash generators?
We see total capital return, and that would be dividends and buybacks,
fair.
Increasing for the industry from $70 billion to over $100 billion over the next 3 to 4 years. So the pace of capital
That's
return
unreal.
At banks is going to be one of the most highest paces among major industries.
I mean, folks, and to be clear here, Mr. Mayo couldn't say there yet, Tom, it's going to be double digit because his compliance people would gouge his eyes out. But I'll say it for you, 70 to 100 over a worst case 5 years. Mike, it gets you out near double digit, doesn't it?
Well, no, and we can certainly say it. It's in our research, Tom. And so double digit growth and return of capital at banks over the next 4 years. At the same time, you have better expense control by controlling branches. At the same time, you have accelerating top line growth.
Michael Mayo, single best buy, please.
You know, we're still going with Citigroup because it's been a laggard. You asked a few minutes ago, you know, what's cheap? They're certainly cheap. They're restructuring. They're not moving as quickly as they should.
Yeah.
So we're going to keep the pressure on them, Tom. We'll go to the annual meeting. But they should have the biggest increase in ROE over the next 4 years.
Michael Mayo, thank you so much. With CLSA on American Banking. Boy, Francine, is that a different discussion than what you and I have with the banking staffing of continental Europe and the United Kingdom?
It is. It's almost night and day, because in Europe, we just need to, you know, keep at it, overhaul, change, boost capital to make sure that we're in a strong position like the U.S. But then a lot of people say, look, European banks look cheap.
I go back to what David Rubenstein said with great force at Davos on the nationalism of European banking. That was a real tangible moment.
Yeah, and I know you're very focused on M&A, but it's difficult when you have one regulator who doesn't want to take systemic risk on.
Exactly. Francine Lacroix in London. I'm Tom Keene in New York. And joining us, it has been way too long since we had a conversation with the king of granularity, John Herman. John, let's do two topics today.
Yes, Tom.
The yield curve, which I'll get to in a second, and then Francine and I will talk about GDP.
Okay, sounds good.
With you. The yield curve, which I've showed 422 times on Bloomberg Surveillance Television, Trump boom, curve steepening.
Yes.
We've been in a tight, tight trading zone. Let's begin. Which way are we going to break? Steeper or flatter on the 210 spread?
I think what's going to happen is, you know, this is a very delicate call because we're actually 210s right now is sort of mid-range. Last year, we were in the 210s flattener. We got in in November of 2015. We rode it like a broken pony right through the summer into the early autumn. Greenspan's old-fashioned quit ratio, he used to talk about 1996, 97, that thing flashed all kinds of crazy signals in early October of 2015, saying get out of the flattener.
And you began to see the steepener right there.
And then we jumped in. We orderly closed out of the flattener, jumped into the steepener about 2 weeks before Trump came in. And then it just broke crazy.
Is the difference in yield between the 10-year and the 2-year, is it about Washington and Trump economics, or there's something else going on?
It's basically You know, it's a Fed view on the one hand and how the Fed will conduct things, you know, in terms of policy normalization and so on. So it's a Fed thing on the front end. On the back end, it's a story about underlying growth. Can the stimulus, you know, the fiscal stimulus get the economy going again, get it going faster, back to 3% and that kind of stuff, return inflation back 2% or higher? Can the stimulus do that? And then on the other hand, it's also kind of this big global positioning thing. Because as you know, I work at Mitsubishi, MUFG Banking Group, and we have, you know, tremendous number of clients in all through Southeast Asia and all through Japan and so on. And, you know, central banks there are all some of our bigger clients, and they have been massive buyers of dips for the last 3 to 4 years. Every pricing dip in 10 years or in 7 years, they came in and bought that sector. And so now, you know, because they can't get the yield elsewhere. So so now the question is, you have those three factors. Fed, how, you know, and like we watched the minutes yesterday, how ready is the committee to start amping up and moving up the policy and tightening and so on?
Well, let's bring...
So that's one thing.
Okay.
And then it's, can we get the growth going again? And then will our foreign guys step away and then wait to reload?
Okay.
Or what will they do?
Let's bring in Francine Lacroix in London. Francine?
Yeah, John, what do you make of when the Fed will actually hike? So I'm looking at Mohamed Alarian, his latest piece, his latest tweet, and he says, look, the market are definitely getting this wrong. The market's implied probability of a March rate increase
it's
are
really
too low.
Yeah, I would. We would agree with that. So our view, you know, the minutes are very interesting because, you know, you have to know where the mindset of the minute of the committee is and what kind of signals they're trying to communicate. So what's really unusual is the participants, again, were more hawkish than the committee. So the participants, the non, you know, the total group, which includes non-voters, they came out and said many of them saw, you know, a basis for raising the Fed funds rate fairly soon. But then when it came to the committee, the voting committee, they said only one was thinking relatively soon, and they said many of the voters thought that they had ample time to respond to inflation pressures because they only think inflation is going to come back to 2% gradually and over the medium term. Our models are saying, no, you're going to be over 2% in inflation by early May. So whether May meeting should be in play. And if Greenspan were running the Fed, you know, we were all sort of groomed on Greenspan and so on. So if Greenspan was running the Fed, his quit ratio pointing to stronger wage growth this year, next year, and into 2019, that's flashing signal saying, you know, you should start moving the market up. And Greenspan always like to move sooner, not later.
John, so, you just talked about models. Give me a model for GDP if nothing bad happens and GDP with the trade war against China.
Okay, so we were thinking, you know, this was a very unusual election. And, you know, if you just to step away and kind of look at it the way an investor would. If we were poised to grow at 2.1, 2.2% this year, if Hillary won. So regardless of what your viewpoint was or anything, because we were due for it, we had to restock inventories, business capex was turning around, underlying, you know, momentum in the housing market, consumer, everything was saying we're growing 2.1, 2.2 this year if Trump doesn't win and if Hillary's in and she does more of her income transfers and so on. We're still growing 2.1, 2.2 this year and probably around 2 to 2.1 in 2019. Now you get some promises of tax reform and fiscal infrastructure spending, which, by the way, we desperately need. This has been the weakest spending recovery on government spending
in 50, 60 years. But, John, you're
but
so good.
But if you
good.
Get that, okay. then you're looking at 2.5, 2.6 this year and 2.9 next year.
Okay, I like the way you frame that. Let me go back to the mathiness of this. Consumption, investment, government, throw in net exports.
Right.
Which partial differential matters to you in getting to a better economy for all Americans?
No. It wouldn't be, because consumer has actually, of all the components of GDP, of domestic demand, consumer has been the outperformer. So, and housing market has been pretty decent. What has been so horribly weak has been business, as former Chairman Greenspan would say, it's business spending on long-term plant and equipment, which directly influences
worker productivity. Is it gone abroad? Is it global?
It's gone. It's definitely moved away because you look at the CapEx on equipment, extremely weak recovery. This recovery
versus
every recovery. It's It's Asia and Mexico. It's also elsewhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So very, very weak there. The second thing is business spending on plant, on factories, on office space, also extremely weak. So as Greenspan says, the key question is to ask, policymakers should be asking, why are businesses unwilling to make these long-term commitments to America, but they're willing to spend the money abroad?
Well,
that's what Greenspan argues, and I think he's right.
Well, and they may discuss that in Mexico City today, folks. Or Michael McKee there. I've got time for one more question. There is a number of houses who suggest the 10-year will be where it is, even go higher, then roll over to a new low disinflation rate.
Yes.
I would be honored if you would comment on that.
Okay, I think, you know, I think the thing is, you know, we're going to look at things from, you know, we've for the last several years, last 7 or 8 years, we've looked at things structurally and cyclically. And the cycle we thought was going to be is an abnormally soft cycle, and structurally we kept seeing all these problems in the labor force. We still see the problems and the challenges in the labor force, very difficult to solve. Some of them are aging, some of them are education, lots of things to talk about. That's a whole segment. But so structurally, but cyclically, if we just get things going, you know, and it doesn't take much, you know, to do the GDP calculus. It doesn't take much to get us to 2.5 to 3% GDP. It really doesn't take much. You could just do infrastructure spending. So we would think yields move up. But I did one of my coworkers from my old days back in Merrill, he used to sit next to me. We had a rate lab group there. And I just sent him something. I said, Walter, I said, you know, you're the tech guy, you sat next to me. I did this stuff. We had this crazy group. We were good. And I was like, you know, where you think it's gonna go low. But there are people who are thinking 10-year yields could go back to 1.3. I think it's gonna be hard unless you get something crazy happen in Europe.
Well, you may get that.
And you may get it.
Okay, we got to leave it there. John Herman, thank you so much with Mitsubishi UFJ. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.